Hey, all right, that's supposed to be 6 minutes long. But it's not. It's only 5 minutes long today. All right, well, cool. I guess I'll just pot that down and we'll just have no intro music today. How about that? I guess in half a minute I could play the intro music for you. This is the Scott Horton Show. I'm Scott Horton. It's the Liberty Express. Liberty Express Radio. Today on the show, a lot of complaining. Also, Reza Marashi from the National Iranian American Council. So, it should be a good show. I got lots of good stuff to talk about. Lots of horrible stuff to talk about. Making me angry. So, check it out. Coming up next on the Scott Horton Show. Well, usually them news things are 6 minutes long. I admit I didn't double check to make sure it was 6 minutes long. I just assumed it would be 6 minutes long. That's the deal. Ah, well, I don't care if you don't. All right. So, welcome to the show. Is it Monday morning again already? God dang. I didn't even get drunk, but I don't even remember the weekend. What happened? I don't know. Well, welcome back to life here, Monday morning. Hope you guys are doing well. Hope you had a good weekend. Hope you didn't have to work too hard. Hope you're able to spend time with people that you care about spending time with. Or at least you made some money or something good. I don't know. Anyway. So Reza Marashi's going to be here. The most important issue going on right now, in fact, this is so funny, I have been such a reliable anti-American government propagandist on the Iran issue for so long. Apparently now the Iranian Fars news agency of the Iranian state has seen fit to tweet directly to me all of their latest headlines. Apparently... they've calculated that I'm their humble servant or something like that. Well, actually, that's not true. I'm an enemy of all states everywhere, including theirs. It's just that I'm in favor of the truth. And everything that my government has on Iran is a damn lie. So, you know, it makes my job easy, actually. You know, what if they had 100 really good reasons to attack Iran and I had to try to stop a war under those circumstances? Well, that would be difficult. You know, stopping the war is difficult in any case, but making the case would be much harder if the war party actually had a case of their own. But instead, all they have is lies, and so all I have to do is tell you what the truth is. And according to the American War Party, and now according to the Iranian state, I work for them, I guess. Well, you guys are all stupid. The Fars News Agency. Speaking of the Fars News Agency today, Max Fisher over at the Washington Post, he picked up on the fact that the Fars News Agency, if that's how you pronounce it, I think that's it, right? Like Farsi, Fars, right? Yeah, F-A-R-S. Iranian state media, that they repeated some ridiculous conspiracy theory story about how the aliens backed Hitler and the National Security Agency and the Snowden documents prove it or something. Well, so as one of the reply tweets immediately points out to him, this was a conspiracy kook story from a conspiracy kook website that the Fars guys, they just aggregated it, basically. They just copied and pasted it, as websites are prone to do. But that didn't stop Max Fisher at the Washington Post from extrapolating this entire point of view about how anyone in Iran who has anything to do with the regime at all, like, say, someone who works at the state media organization, Fars, who has such a hard line, black and white point of view about the world with America as the bad guys. Well, that just proves that those people just can't be dealt with or reasoned with because of what a bad attitude they have. And he even admits, hey, it's not like this guy's speaking for the president, who we're actually negotiating with right now over there. But everybody knows that the president over there is beset on all sides by people just like this. Wait, what now? How many steps away are we from someone at the Forest News Agency found something at, you know, wannabe what really happened, right? It wasn't even from there. It was from total kook town. They copied and pasted it. Yeah, space aliens controlled Hitler, like Weekly World News stuff. Oh, yeah, but you know what? There's all kind of lessons to be learned here, according to Max Fisher, about whether we can have a nuclear deal with Iran or not. Yeah, well, you know what? I read some conspiracy kookery at the Washington Post, closely tied to the American regime, I'll have you know, where they believe that the Iranians are making nuclear weapons, and that this is these negotiations are a last-ditch attempt to try to stop them from doing so. And that, in fact, if you read what somebody copied and pasted from a kook website onto their state news organization site, that you can extrapolate from there what every other stupid idiot in their entire government thinks, and then you can conclude that there ain't no point trying to do business with them. Look at what a bunch of crazies they are. Sounds pretty crazy to me. Jeez, where'd you pick up that nutcasery, Scott Horton? What bowels of neoconservative, you know, scumdom online have you been scraping to come up with that stuff? That was in the Washington Post. Yeah, in the Washington Post. They said that if Iranian state media copies and pastes something from American kook media, then that means that you can't really do a nuclear deal with people like that. Not that Max Fisher or anyone at the Washington Post has an agenda against Iran or anything. Give me a break. Who are these people? You know what? I came up with a reason why you can't do a nuclear deal with Iran too, guys. Pay attention to me for a minute. That is a direct quote of Max Fisher. Hey, everybody, since this week what we're trying to come up with is reasons why not to have a peace deal. I got one. I saw on their site that they copied and pasted a thing about flying saucers. So you can see right there why. You know, Hitler. Did I mention Hitler? Yeah, Hitler. Anyway, I'm sorry, that sounds all so stupid, but no, really, that's at the Washington Post. They've got influence, man. They're the agenda-setting media in America. They set the terms of the debate at the Washington Post. Those are the terms that they set. I got a problem with that, personally, actually. You know, I can't stand Barack Obama. I've been better at hating him than all y'all combined this whole time. And I've never hated him for a wrong reason. All you goofballs who think he's a Marxist from Kenya and all of this crap. I've hated him for only actual good reasons to hate him this whole time. I mean, he is half a commie, I guess, but really, he's more like a half-white conservative, corporatist, imperialist, nationalist, fascist type, like George W. Bush, only a little bit taller. That's what he really is. And I've hated him since I ever first heard of his name. And somewhere I have the file where I can prove it. January 07, I say, who's this Barack Obama guy? I hate his guts because I saw on CNN that supposedly I love him and that he's a rock star. Oh, he's a rock star and I love him, huh? Yeah, we'll see about that. I hate this guy. The only thing he's ever done that I support is stuff that he hasn't done. He always backs down on everything good he ever promised to do. But sometimes he backs down on horrible stuff too. And I support his backing down from the horrible stuff he was going to do from time to time. These negotiations with Iran are, as far as I can think of, the only positive action he's taken in any respect whatsoever that I support. I mean, really, all he has to do to end the Cold War with Iran is just call it off. But in the real world, you know, the evil empire of Washington, D.C., that's not how it works. The best we're going to be able to do is have him negotiate the one supposed point of contention that stands above and beyond all the others, the nuclear program. And everybody who says that they're most concerned about Iran's nuclear technology are all the very same people who are doing everything they can to prevent the president from negotiating a deal to limit Iran's nuclear technology. Huh, it's almost as if they are dishonest brokers. Jeez, it's almost as though we've all known all along what they want is war. What they want is regime change. And moderation and negotiation are the enemies of war and regime change. And that's why they do what they do and say the ridiculous things that they say. Anyway, Reza Marashi's going to be on the show to talk about some of that today on the show. He's got a lot more sunny disposition than me. We're going to hear the positive spin on what's happening with those negotiations from him. But, ooh, I got Somalia news after this. Ooh. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. Hey, Al Scott here, inviting you to check out Modern Times Magazine at ModernTimesMagazine.com. It's a great little independent publication out of Phoenix, Arizona, featuring unique views on economics, politics, foreign policy, sports, and music, with great art scene coverage and fiction writing as well. That's Modern Times Magazine at ModernTimesMagazine.com. So how do you like it? New spots! I know they're pretty much the same as the old spots, but they're new and different, right? Does that help? I know they're way overdue, too, new spots on the show, so hope you guys like it. And I think I got my bumper music all normalized for us now, so that ought to be slightly helpful. It's hard work, but we're making progress. Can't quantify what that could possibly mean for you, but yeah. All right, it's the show, the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. And man, I sent out a mess of invites this morning, and I didn't get nearly as many responses as I would have liked, and the responses that I did get, why, the majority of them were in the negative. But that's okay, because Reza Marashi's going to be here, and that's going to be good. And it's also okay because I got a lot of rain checks, so I'm already stacking them up for the rest of the week. Good guests on the Scott Horton Show. That's what I like doing, is interviewing people about all the stuff they're right about. You know, you hear enough nonsense in media. It's my job to give you access to help, you know, bring you the people who I think you ought to be reading. The true stuff. The good stuff. Instead of the same old. And I guess, you know, the show would be more entertaining if I would focus on bringing the bad guys on and fighting with them and stuff like that. Maybe I should do that. Make a little bit more money that way, probably. But really, I just want you to hear Gareth Porter, you know? I just want you to know about what's going on. I'm not really very good at the business end of this thing. All right. Well, you tell me, focus group, whether this is good for business or not. I don't care. I'm talking about this. U.S. military advisors sent to help Somalia fight al-Shabaab in Syria. from January the 10th in the New York Times, the Pentagon has sent a small team of uniformed military advisors to Somalia. You know, this is one of my Barack Obama bumper stickers from 2007. Oh, I was anti-war until my number one hero became the president. Now I love war. On to Somalia! And, you know, he only had sent the drones and the spies. And I was wondering what was taking him so long. And of course, I think I was wondering that on the 10th. Jeez, I wonder why they haven't done a full-scale invasion of Somalia yet. Oh, here we go. The Pentagon has sent a small team of uniformed military advisors to Somalia, the first American troops assigned there since 1993 when 18 Americans were killed in the failed Black Hawk Down mission. But in a reflection of the administration's caution in deploying United States forces to the strife-torn nation, the presence is tiny, at least for now, three advisors, a Defense Department official claimed on Friday. See, if I was a billionaire and I owned the media or whatever, all of my journalists and editors would be under explicit instructions that anytime any government official says anything, the term in our paper is claimed. You know, to emphasize the unproven nature of their assertions all the time, to demonstrate a lack of deference and presumption of legitimacy and honesty. For them, how could it possible? How could any publisher put out a newspaper with a straight face and do it any other way, huh? A Defense Department official claimed on Friday. The advisors were deployed to the Somali capital of Mogadishu last month to help provide logistics, planning, and communications assistance to Somali and other African forces combating Al-Shabaab, the Islamic militant group, according to the official who spoke anonymously to discuss the mission. Al-Shabaab fighters carried out the bloody siege at a shopping mall in Nairobi, Kenya last September, in which more than 60 men, women, and children were killed. The U.S. has established, the U.S. has established a military coordination cell in Somalia to provide planning and advisory to support to the African Union mission in Somalia and Somali security forces to increase their capabilities and promote peace and security throughout Somalia and the region. Oh, yeah. Look out, Somalis. You thought we'd starved you to death already. Well, those of you who survived that, beware. Sorry, I know there are no borders for you to safely run across from where you're stranded right now, but here comes the Peace and Security Brigade to help you. Colonel Tom Davis, spokesman for the military's Africa Command, claimed in a statement on Friday, in response to an online report by the Washington Post, the Obama administration has been edging closer toward reversing a policy in place for decades that effectively bars American, quote, boots on the ground in Somalia. In January 2013, the U.S. officially recognized a new federal government in Somalia, reestablishing diplomatic ties for the first time in decades. State Department has not yet reopened an embassy in Mogadishu, but officials from the American embassy in Nairobi visit there frequently. Almost done. General David Rodriguez, the head of the African Command, made an initial trip into Mogadishu last summer. Last October, Amanda J. Dory, the Pentagon's top policy official for Africa, told the Senate committee the military would increase its presence in Mogadishu in tandem with the State Department. The CIA has long maintained a covert presence in the country, at times financing its security services, and American Special Operations Forces have periodically conducted drone strikes or commando raids. And thank you for adding that at the end there. Of course, they're leaving out the fact that Jeremy Scahill documented a CIA and JSOC, that's Military Joint Special Operations Command, run prison in Mogadishu. And then Eli Lake, wait, don't change the channel. In this particular case, Eli Lake's reporting seemed like it could have been legit. He reported that, hey, there's a whole other CIA Special Forces run prison up in Puntland. And of course, the JSOC has been involved in helicopter raids, snatch and grab missions, and whatever. That's not all CIA. That's the JSOC has been running around in there. And of course, the New York Times left out the fact that all along, from the very beginning of the war for regime change in Somalia starting in Christmas 2006, the CIA and the JSOC invaded with the Ethiopians in the first place, made them do it, as Rob Prince wrote about from the WikiLeaks. Thank you, Chelsea Manning. But it was even in the Washington Post, and I think at the New York Times at the time. Certainly it was in the Washington Post at the time that Special Forces and CIA C-130 gunships were flying around machine gunning people to death and whatever on the at the invasion. And of course, they were also involved in the rendition of at least dozens, perhaps hundreds of people back to Ethiopia, where many of them were tortured. And this included at least one American citizen. And now that I think about it, I think it might have been two. And anyway, I'll ask you to go and read... Well, jeez. Now I can say, I'll ask you to go and read the single best retelling of all of this is by me. You know, because I made it that way the best I could. You know, in one article format for you anyway. It's Washington, U.S. government. That's what it is. U.S. government to blame for Somalia's misery. You can find it at scotthorton.org/articles. You can find it at fff.org. U.S. government to blame for Somalia's misery. And I did my very best, at least, to synthesize all the best different journalism that I know of on the subject. And I will also, of course, as I do in the article, I'll point you toward Jeremy Scahill's work in The Nation magazine. And the title is always on the tip of my tongue, except for right now. Is it Blowback in Somalia? Yeah, because Backfires is the Yemen one. Yeah, Blowback in Somalia. And you know what? It's a little bit narrative heavy about his time palling around with these warlords and whatever, but it's good reading, and especially if you skip to the second half, he gets more of the details. And in fact, I think there's just like one or two really good paragraphs together where he tells the whole story, the history from the year 2000 or so on, or even going back. And anyway, you know, for those of you who are regular listeners to this show, you know the story, like, you know, as well as I do by heart by now, or something like that. Maybe you're sick of hearing me talk about it. On the other hand, if you're not a regular listener to this show, or maybe you're new around here and you don't know the story of it, it kills me that you don't know about this. And it's just not fair. It's like the interview Sunday on the KPFK show with Barry Lando, where we talked about how it's just not fair that the American people have no idea of the pain and suffering and destruction that they brought to Iraq over the last decade. They have never had to come face to face whatsoever. The polls say in Britain, we talked about this, and I don't know if they ever did a poll in America, but in Britain they did a poll, and the average Brit, and you'd figure they would know more and be exposed to more international news than most Americans, in their poll, most Brits thought that only 20,000 people had died or less in the Iraq War. What are you kidding me? You mean in 2003? Yeah, but what about the other 8 years of it? Are you kidding me? 20,000? And it just ain't fair to have that level of grief and destruction and despair and death brought by one nation to another and have this population completely oblivious. To me, it's almost as bad of a sin, or not to put it in a religious way, but it's just, it's as distasteful as the actual death itself and the lies surrounding it. That everybody here who's at least, come on, a little bit responsible, I mean, I don't really mean to put it on you, but I feel like I'm a little bit responsible. You know, I know this isn't a real democracy, and my vote doesn't mean anything anyway and whatever, but it is true that if the American people had a, hey, stop killing Somalis right now point of view, then that's the reality that we would live with. Our government would stop killing Somalis. But Americans don't even care to know, and they don't know the first thing. And that just ain't right. So, I'm here to tell you, it's a microcosm of the whole terror war. You pick a fight, and then you go, oh, look, I'm in a fight. Now I've got an excuse to fight. And then the U.S. Empire just makes it worse and worse and worse. And they lead to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians. Hundreds of thousands. And, you know, the famine helped, but it was mostly the war. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Yeah, Eric Margulies last Friday, or last Thursday, I guess, mentioned this Somalia thing. Said, yep, now look at him going back to Somalia more. And I thought, huh? I didn't realize that there was more to that story coming out. And there you go. And of course, you know, this New York Times article, you know, I'll admit I didn't go and read every other piece of American media who mentioned this at all. I don't know if any of them did, really. Very many of them did. But at least, you know, the New York Times, that's the newspaper of record. And you can just see, if you know the story at all, you can see the gigantic, glaring errors of omission here. I mean, this article by Eric Schmidt, whether by design or whether by ignorance or whether, you know, maybe he did a good job, but then his editors just didn't let all that good truth make it to print, or whatever the problem is there at the New York Times with this one. There's a gigantic history of the American government killing Somalis that's not in this article. What the hell's an Al-Shabaab, New York Times? Where did they ever come from? What policy are they the blowback about, huh? You're not going to tell me about the blowback, New York Times? Oh, guys, hey, guess what? I heard that the other day, Magic Land spit out a brand new territory on Earth called Somalia. It has no history, certainly none that you need to know about. And it's a place where things aren't perfect, and so now we have to go and help it with our military. Got that? Doesn't matter history. What history? What do you mean everything wrong in Somalia is America's fault in the first place? What does that have to do with anything? We have to go and help them. And man, did you see this thing? Let me see. I think I have the link here. Jeez, I want to get the quotes for you so that you don't doubt me and think, Scott Horton, you're a liar, because that couldn't possibly be true, that they would be so bad, that they would be so crass. Oh yeah, check it out. From Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting by Peter Hart. Why did the U.S. invade Iraq? The answer, nice talking, I'm Benadryl excuse today again. I got the hay fever so bad, but the Benadryl, it works good, but it also has its side effects. January 10th, 2014. Why did the U.S. invade Iraq? The answer in 2014. By Peter Hart at fair.org. Reports of Al-Qaeda-linked fighters taking over the Iraqi city of Fallujah, which is not exactly the whole story, but anyway, have prompted a lot of media coverage about the U.S. sacrifice there. In the process, the history of the war is being dramatically rewritten. ABC World News anchor Diane Sawyer on January the 6th announced, quote, "There's a worrying new sign that Al-Qaeda is on the march in two countries cracked by war. One of them is Iraq, where so many brave American troops fought to create a future." End quote. So that's what the Iraq War was about, creating a future. ABC correspondent Terry Moran continued the theme, explaining that after a decade of U.S.-led war to plant democracy in Iraq, much of Fallujah has now fallen to Al-Qaeda. So, the war was a democracy-planting mission, and one that's apparently gone awry. Moran went on. Al-Qaeda's takeover of Fallujah brings back bitter memories for Americans. It was here in 2004 that U.S. Marines fought a ferocious house-to-house battle against Iraqi insurgents. More than 100 Marines gave their lives to pacify the city, and hundreds more were injured. Peter Hart continues, as I've noted elsewhere, and I'm going a little far afield here, but I swear I'm coming back to Somalia in a second. As I've noted elsewhere, Fairblog 1614, this memory of Fallujah as a place where mostly Americans suffered does serious damage to the historical record. Fallujah was the site of two massive attacks by the U.S. military, where an untold number of civilians, hundreds if not thousands, were killed. That record, which included the use of cluster bombs and white phosphorus, is not one media are keen to remember. It's not just ABC. Time Magazine's Aaron Baker explained it was Fallujah where, quote, U.S. forces redeemed the possibility of a peaceful Iraq. Fighting house to house, up close and personal, in a costly but successful effort to clear the city of insurgents and make it safe for handover to Iraqi government forces. So at the 10-year mark, some reporters recall Fallujah as a place where U.S. forces redeemed the possibility of peaceful Iraq. And the Iraq War is a noble effort to plant democracy. It boggles the mind what they'll be telling us about the Iraq War in 2024. And, you know, it's almost a waste of time to talk about this. But, you know, you kind of got to confront all these arguments on the level at which they're waged. And the fact is that this war is for the good of the people of Iraq was a narrative that they never stopped selling the entire time. And there are some who believe that that really was the mission. That was one of the quotes I read in the Marines, one of the disappointed Marines who said, you know, geez, 20-year-old me back in Fallujah in 04, I believed I was there to help the people who were suffering under, you know, really mean people who ruled them, and geez, now it turned out that they're back. And meanwhile, it's not really Al-Qaeda that took over Fallujah. It's the people of Fallujah. It's the tribal leaders in Fallujah have started up their Sunni-based insurgency against the Shiite, American, and Iranian-backed government again. It was always a lie that the Sunni-based insurgency in Iraq was all Al-Qaeda. They were only, in fact, even the generals admitted this from time to time, they were only ever 2 or 3% of the insurgency. Zarqawi and his guys tolerated as long as they were helpful, and then stabbed in the back and destroyed as soon as they pushed their luck too far. In fact, Gareth and I were talking about this on the show last week. At one point, I even had my footnotes all together off the top of my head where I could prove to you that the Sunni tribal leaders in the summer of 03, just a couple of months after the war, and then again in the summer of 04, 05, 06, came to the military saying, please, just let us patrol our own neighborhoods and we will kill off all these jihadi crazies for you. And the American policy was to not go along with that until they finally went along with it after the Shiites had completely taken Baghdad and created a civil war, which, you know, the Americans, it couldn't have happened. The Badr Brigade couldn't have done it without the U.S. Army. Get real. And they killed, you know, upwards of somewhere between 500,000 and a million people died in that civil war. Or, you know, indirectly from it. And then in 2006, they said, oh, okay, you want to patrol your own neighborhoods and we'll give you, you know, AKs and some money, as long as you don't attack Americans. That had been Petraeus's policy up in Mosul back in 04, but he couldn't get anybody else in the military on the same page as him. And so, all of his money and guns went straight to the insurgency and, you know, talk about fast and furious. Nobody ever talks about David Petraeus giving so many guns to the Sunni insurgents who used them on American soldiers later for years afterwards. But anyway, it was the same policy again, only years afterwards. And in fact, I'm trying to remember now if this was on the radio or if this was just another conversation I was having. We were talking about how... No, it was this is a conversation I was having off the air with somebody. The attacks on Fallujah. You know, it's such a fascinating story. Yeah, Clock, I'm looking at you. Oh, man, I got to get back to Somalia. What happened was there was a riot over everybody being fired because Douglas Feith and Paul Bremer fired the entire Iraqi army. And then so the Sunnis were sitting around wondering how they were going to eat. The Sunnis of Anbar province, and there was a giant protest, and who knows exactly who fired first, I'm not sure, but the Marines opened fire and killed, I think, 17 people, and so tempers were hot, and then the Israelis assassinated Sheikh Yassin, who, with the help of the Mossad in the first place, had created Hamas back in the days. He was an old man in a wheelchair at the time that they killed him, and then when they did, that caused a major riot, and... You know what, I may be screwing up this story a little bit, but I think it was in that riot was when the Blackwater Guards were, grabbed and lynched and their corpses burned and hung from the bridge in Fallujah. And then the first Fallujah operation then in the spring of 2004 was just revenge for that. It was, we're going to go in there, we're going to show these terrorists who's a real tough guy around here and that we can't be messed with. They didn't have a real strategy or a policy of, you know, pacifying the city, cutting a deal with anyone, sharing power, you know, democracy or any of that crap. They were just going to get back at them for that. And in there, and then they did it again after Bush was safely reelected in November of 2004. They attacked again. And what they did was they drove the entire population of Fallujah out of the city. Well, where'd they go? They went to stay with friends and relatives in Baghdad. And then that led to the displacement of a lot of Shiites from Shiite neighborhoods or from mixed, you know, predominantly Sunni neighborhoods in Baghdad, where then those Shiites had to go and stay with their friends and neighbors in other Shiite neighborhoods. And then those Sunnis got displaced. And this was, and we're talking about a flood of refugees here, hundreds of thousands of people. And this is what helped to precipitate the civil war in Baghdad, as all these displaced populations, it was 4 million, 4.5 million total. Half went to Jordan and Syria, about a quarter each, and the other half were internally displaced. And so there was all kinds of then sectarian cleansing and militias forming up and whatever, and this is what really helped precipitate the start of the Civil War in 2004, was America's assaults on Fallujah. And then we got to read all this crap about how, sacrifice to give them a chance at democracy and freedom and a better life and all of this. Really? What, is it still 2004? Nobody's picked up on a single fact about that actual occupation and what really went on there. An American war for Abdulaziz al-Hakim and the Iraqi traitors of the Badr Corps who took Iran's side when Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan had Saddam invade Iran. And then America fought a war to put them in power, to kill upwards of 1 million people, to put the Badr Corps in there. And then, of course, the surge was an entire failure that supposedly vindicated the war. All the surge did was help solidify the Badr Corps' grasp on power, and they've frozen everyone else out, which has led to the current resurgence, which has really been going on for a year and a half or more now, of the Sunni insurgency. Oh yeah, and I was supposed to get back to Somalia. Uh-oh, mistimed something, didn't I? Oh yeah, that's not going to click over for another half a minute. Good job, Scott. Well, I'll take this time to tell you you're listening to Liberty Express. This is the Scott Horton Show. You can also check out my website at scotthorton.org. Keep all my interview archives there now. Over 3,000 of them. Hey, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton.
Support Hanford Liberty Stickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's...
Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of the Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for the Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's the Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me you heard it here. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, look, everybody, today's guest, Reza Meraji's on CNN. Oh, okay, it's over now. I try to keep it on CNN International in the background. Not that it's any good, but they tend to talk less about domestic American politics. You know, what governor closed what road and whatever crap. So it's just easier on my patience and my temper to be on out of the corner of my eye there. They're just interviewing Reza Meraji. He's coming up on our show here in just a few. He's a former State Department guy and now with the National Iranian American Council working to create peace between this state and that one, which I'm for. I really like Reza, too. He's a good guy. Real smart guy. All right. So listen, I'm sorry. I went way too far off on that Iraq thing. There's just too many dang things to say about Iraq in one segment to get back to where I started, which was Somalia and how they can sit here really and argue that they kill people in Somalia because they love them. After everything we've all already learned over all of this time, we're supposed to have forgotten it all. We're supposed to believe that the reason that they killed Fallujah over and over again was because they love Fallujah. Because they're trying to help save Fallujah, you know, from the fighting aged males of Fallujah. Like the Brits were fighting to save Lexington and Concord from the American colonists who lived there. Indeed, as Peter Hart says, can you imagine what they're going to say about why they did it in 2024? How far off the story from the truth will be by then? And you know, one of the things I was going to interrupt myself and say while I was going through that was about how, you know, I've seen this happen in my life now. I really understand why history is always wrong about everything. Is because history is just the lie they get away with on the day-to-day basis. And that's all anybody ever remembers or writes down. I remember it wasn't even a history book. It was my Psychology 101 textbook in junior college. Had a, at a Austin Community College. Had a little subchapter on that crazy cult of Branch Davidians who all committed mass suicide by fire in 1993. And I remember thinking, come on, nobody really believes that anymore. Maybe you are willing to break your spine bending over backwards to tell yourself that surely it wasn't the cops that set those kids on fire that day, you know, back at the time. Because then, you know, it might have been incumbent on you to do something about it somehow or something, you know, run for office or become a journalist or. But after years later, that's the official history of Waco now. It's as far as school textbooks go. Same thing for Iraq. Why did America attack Iraq? Pick your reason as long as it ain't true. Just don't say Israel. Don't say because the Ayatollah Khamenei sent Ahmed Chalabi to fool the pro-Israel fifth column in Washington, D.C. into lying you and your dad into supporting the damn thing. Just don't say that. You can blame it on Houston if you want, I guess. And yeah, you might be a little bit right about that, but not mostly. But, oh, I know, how about we went because there was a real concern that Saddam was making nuclear bombs and would give them to terrorists like Osama bin Laden to use against us. Huh? Does anybody now think that that was a real reason? You notice Diane Sawyer didn't bring that up. Diane Sawyer had, and well, her teleprompter writers had to resort to, well, geez, what do we call it when we, the motive here? How about, I don't know, to give them a future. That's vague enough. Yeah, I don't remember a year straight of lies trying to scare your mom into supporting that war. Well, I heard Saddam's going to kill us all if we don't kill them all first. Yeah, I heard that too. Bunch of times. But no, oh yeah, no, we only did it just to help them because we all love Arabs so much. And coincidentally, all the same people who love them so much that they want to do this for them are the very same people who don't care how many of them have to die in order for the project to be complete. And they're also the same people who, they don't care if the project is complete. They never bothered the whole time in arguing with the war party during that Iraq war. They never bothered to even learn who was who. And I don't mean, you know, the National Security Council. They knew who they were backing. I don't know if they knew why. But, you know, the average war supporter in America, they never had any idea what they were talking about. Any more than the soldiers. Soldiers would write into antiwar.com. Looking, as Robert Gates said, talking about the collateral murder video, he said, oh, look, when you look at that collateral murder video, the Apache helicopter just wasting these people on the ground, civilians with cameras, reporters, well, you're just looking at the war through a soda straw. Well, guess what? Those Apache helicopter pilots, they're just looking at the war through a soda straw, too. They had no idea who they were killing, or why, or what. Whose militia was on whose side. You know, and I said this the other day, but I think it's important. Of all the letters I got from soldiers and from pro-war people writing into antiwar.com back when that was my job there, was to answer those letters, and they trailed off. They kind of quit writing in. But all of their pro-war letters, I would always ask them about who's who and whatever. None of them could had any idea who was the Supreme Islamic Council, who's Muqtada al-Sadr, who used to be the Ba'athists and who used to support them, and whose side are the Kurds allied with, and what? None of them knew nothing about it. None of them knew nothing about it at all, other than, I believe in it. It's a mission. We got to finish it. We got to finish the mission. Got to complete it. It won't be completed until it's done. You mean when the Dawa Party and the Supreme Islamic Council and the Sadrists coalition backed by Iran rules all the land from Baghdad to Basra, standing on 500,000 skulls. That's when the mission will be complete? Is that what you mean to say? Yeah, hey, we're giving them a future. Fighting for their democracy. Democracy, future, help them. And that argument wins. Not me pulling all their pants down and pointing out that they don't know nothing about nothing in the war that they argue so strenuously for. No, that's the argument that wins. Support troops. Support mission. Win mission. Don't change horses in midstream. God dang, dude, what are we, human being grown adults or minor birds in this society? Hi, I just finished minor bird school. I've been listening to talk radio all day. Watch me. All the weapons of mass destruction? Well, he had them, but then he moved them to Syria with help from the Russians. Yeah, I heard it on Sean Hannity 3 different times. Anyway, we just went there to help them. To give them a future. They weren't going to have a future. They were actually frozen in time there, like on Bewitched. And they were going to be stuck back behind in the 1990s forever if America didn't invade and kill them. But now we've given them a future. Ask probably the most well-known news lady in America, Diane Sawyer. She's a straight shooter. She'll explain it to you. And, of course, Diane Sawyer doesn't know what the Dawa Party is. She's never heard of it. She covered that war for 8 years, but she didn't know what's the Dawa Party. She might have seen that word before, but it never even led to a follow-up question, not ever, not once. What's a Dawa party? Who are they? Do they have an agenda or anything that we might examine? And then now, these are the people arguing, according to the New York Times, at least by omission. It's time to begin. To begin. To help the Somalis. We're sending advisors over there. Apparently, history began yesterday. And there's a Shabab thing. That the people of Somalia somehow are separate and distinct from. And they need protecting from it. You know, the fighting age males of Mogadishu. And, you know, I don't know. If America's murdered 250,000 Somalis so far, maybe they can kill the rest of them by 2025. And now, again, that's not entirely fair. I did get caught up by the break there before, like I'm about to do again. There was a famine. There was a terrible famine. But it was the American war that destroyed every last bit of capitalism in Somalia. America had, like Michael Ledeen says in The Doctrine, ask Jonah Goldberg, you pick up a tiny, helpless little country and you slam it against the wall just to show you mean business. And that slamming them against the wall had destroyed every market relationship. Every distribution network, every amount of capital available to invest in growing food to feed to people. And they died. 250,000 of them died. More than half of them, children under 5 years old, starved to death because of America. Not that you can read about that by Jeffrey Gettleman or Eric Schmidt in the New York Times.
Hey, all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else is stickers suck.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Check out my website, scotthorton.org. I keep all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. Also, check out scotthorton.org/documentaries, where I'm compiling a collection of all the best documentaries that I've ever seen and would recommend to you, I guess, that I can think of. Some pretty good stuff there. It's far from complete. But anyway, check that out. Lots of really good stuff. Movies, films, endeavors for you to examine at scotthorton.org/documentaries. Also, I'm just starting. Maybe some of this would be old hat to you. Maybe not. I don't know. But at scotthorton.org/fair use, I'm collecting just kind of best of anti-war writings from the past. Journalism, long-lost journalism, but then, you know, Lysander Spooner, the constitutional authority, and then Jefferson's inaugural and Washington's farewell and John Quincy Adams' 4th of July address and all those, you know, anti-interventionist oldies and goodies. Oh, that reminds me, I should get Eugene Debs' speech on the draft that got him put in prison by Woodrow Wilson. And, I got War is the Health of the State by Randolph Bourne and a lot of other good stuff. If you want to check out some good readings there, scotthorton.org/fair use. And again, if you want to read my great article about Somalia, and it is good. I'm proud of this one. It's not perfect writing wise. After a little bit of time going back and looking at it. And I think the copy editor there is from another planet or something. So he kind of changed my stuff in a way that made it not better. Anyway, I don't care. It's a good article. I stand by it. It's at scotthorton.org/articles, and it's the top one. U.S. government responsible for Somalia's misery. And I think it's a really important one, so read it and pass it around if you like bad news. If you like context, be on the New York Times version, where history always begins yesterday. Hey, guess what happened, guys? Something that was the first cause in the universe was not caused by any other preceding thing at all. All right, now check this out. I don't know why I didn't try to get her on the show. Why didn't I try to get her on the show? Lazy. I'm going to try to get her on the show for tomorrow. It's Hannah Alam at McClatchy. I really like their reporters. I mean, they're not perfect because they're reporters, but they do a pretty good job. And this thing, man, this just about blows my mind. I don't know. You tell me what you think. By the way, scotthorton.org/chat or Facebook or twitter.com/scotthortonshow if you want to tell me what you think. McClatchyDC.com. West may not be winner in Syria battle of good Al-Qaeda versus bad Al-Qaeda. Oh, boy. Only on the complex and bloody battlefields of Syria could there emerge a schism that would seem absurd elsewhere. Good Al-Qaeda versus bad Al-Qaeda. That concept is becoming increasingly accepted as Syrian fighters intensify their campaign to reclaim the mantle of the rebel cause from extremists who'd become as formidable an enemy as President Bashar Assad, the autocrat who they failed to topple after nearly 3 years of war. Analysts who monitor the Syrian insurgency caution that the rebel forces fighting are taking territory from the feared Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or ISIS, are themselves no longer champions of a Western-style democratic plan for Syria. The fighters run the spectrum. They never were. The fighters run the spectrum from avowed Al-Qaeda loyalists to ultra-conservatives who want no cooperation with the West to two new groupings of more mainstream rebels who complain that the Obama administration has abandoned their struggle. As a result, the analysts say, a development that from afar might appear to be encouraging, rebels uniting to isolate the most ruthless faction, in fact comes with a host of caveats and new concerns, not least that ISIS will return with a vengeance. And it doesn't resolve the fact that the United States still lacks a proven rebel partner in the conflict, a major snag to U.S. plans to build a strong opposition delegation to sit across from regime representatives at a long-anticipated peace summit that's scheduled to begin in just 2 weeks. Yes, we're closer to having a leadership of the opposition that can actually presume to call the shots in rebel Syria, but it's not one we're going to like very much. Yeah, or one that you can bring to Geneva either. That's a quote from Joshua Landis from the University of Oklahoma and the blog Syria comment. In several instances, according to reports, ISIS is simply handing over posts to its sometimes ally, the al-Nusra Front, that's Jabhat al-Nusra, a U.S.-designated al-Qaeda affiliate that enjoys good relations with a cross-section of rebel brigades and which has assumed a mediator role in the current violence. The brutalities of ISIS make the Nusra Front, itself no stranger to beheadings and kidnappings, look downright moderate by comparison. While Nusra Front fighters occasionally have joined in the battle against ISIS on a localized basis, Syria observers say as an organization its stance seems intentionally ambiguous. The real change against ISIS comes from two factions that were formed of the remnants of the U.S.-backed Free Syrian Army, and from the new ultra-conservative powerhouse, the Islamic Front. More than 250 people died in the fighting, and the Islamic Front is just the Free Syrian Army with the new name. What's powerhouse about it? More than 250 people died in the fighting of recent days, and ISIS has either surrendered or been routed from its dozens of positions, according to news and witness reports. The balancing act for al-Nusra is that it wants to preserve its good relations with the other more moderate fighting groups, but it can't be seen as selling out its ideological twin, ISIS, even though ISIS technically is no longer an al-Qaeda affiliate after openly defying the orders of the terrorist network's commander, Ayman al-Zawahiri, to stop its incursion into Syria. Al-Nusra has consistently played its cards right in Syria. It's been remarkably smart in managing its public relations. said Charles Lister, who focuses on the Syrian civil war as a visiting fellow at the Doha Center of the Brookings Institution. It has maintained healthy relations with rebel groups of all ideological kinds, and its military might and demonstrated capacity to positively influence battles has made it a highly influential group. Man, so I'm not going to be able to finish this in the time. Well, maybe. What the hell am I going to try? The relationship to watch, analysts say, is how the Nusra Front interacts in the future with the Islamic Front. Both groups emphasize that their problems with ISIS aren't ideological, but because of their rivals' imperious attitude and refusal to enter into power-sharing agreements. Their hope is that ISIS foot soldiers will drift away to either Nusra or the Islamic Front, preventing an intra-jihadist showdown in what's already a free-for-all. Rebel supporters, Landis said, are now on a charm offensive to portray Nusra as the good al-Qaeda, an organization that's only focused on the Syrian arena, is playing nicely with rival factions, and which doesn't have ambitions to attack the U.S. or its allies. Nusra and the Islamic Front have something else in common, an open channel to Ayman al-Zawahiri. As the Long War Journal reported last month, a senior al-Qaeda operative known by the alias Abu Khalid al-Suri is a leading figure in the Islamic Front and is close to the bloc's leader, Hassan Aboud. The Long War Journal, citing intelligence sources, described al-Suri as an al-Qaeda courier whose Spanish authorities suspect delivered surveillance tapes of the World Trade Center and other American landmarks to al-Qaeda leadership in Afghanistan in early 1998.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe.
Even if one were to decide that the Islamic Front is moderate, ideological, which it's besides the point anyway, so it doesn't matter. Even if one were to decide that the Islamic Front is moderate, ideologically, they still don't like the West and don't want Western assistance, said Ayman al-Tamimi, who analyzes radical Islamist groups in Syria and Iraq for the Philadelphia-based Middle East Forum. Tamimi added that relatively moderate fighters who want a more democratic future for Syria are worried that their uneasy, fluid cooperation with the Islamists will sour once ISIS is out of the picture or absorbed into the other factions. Nevertheless, the Obama administration is making overtures to Aboud and his fighters. The White House acknowledged Friday that it's even considering restarting aid shipments to the rebel movement, of which the Islamic Front is taking charge. Shipments were suspended last month when U.S.-backed moderate rebels, quote-unquote, rebel command, FSA command, saw its headquarters and warehouses pillaged by Islamist forces. Aboud is clearly keeping an open channel to Zawahiri and maybe getting funding, but America has no choice here, Landis said. America's reaching out to him and saying, don't write us off, let's talk. You don't really want to be with al-Qaeda. Oh my God. And then so in 15 seconds, the music's going to start playing and we're going to have to take this break. But when we come back, I got about 10 things to say about this. I know I interrupted myself to comment 6 times or something, but well, you know, that's what I'm here for. It's news analysis, right? Yeah. So first, I stumble through the text of an entire McClatchy piece, and then I try to sell you some coffee and some Murray Rothbard statues, and then I come back and explain. It's a fair deal. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right. Welcome back to the show. Reza Meraji's coming up. We're going to talk about Iran and sanctions and AIPAC and all that. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm here 3 to 5 Eastern Time on Liberty Express Radio, libertyexpressradio.com. Also streaming from my own site, scotthorton.org. Follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /Scott Horton Show. If you're into that kind of thing. All right. And then, so listen, all I want to say about this basically was about how, well, you know, it's that crazy old commie dialectic, same as always. Here, just a few months back, as we can all remember, the al-Nusra Front, why, those guys are al-Qaeda guys. They're suicide bombers and prisoner beheaders, and they have declared outright their loyalty to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the leader of al-Qaeda, from whatever basement he's hiding in. I'm not sure how you lead from a basement. But anyway, he leads by podcast. And anyway, these guys are now the ones that the Obama administration is cozying up to. Where the hell is that that John McCain here? John McCain says Iraq needs U.S. help to fight al-Qaeda. No, no, not boots on the ground, he says. It's too late for that. Wah. But we gotta help, and we gotta give them Apache helicopters. Let's give them Apache helicopters. After all, we occupied the place with plenty of Apache helicopters for 8 years and completely eradicated al-Qaeda. So that proved that Apache helicopters are really good at eradicating al-Qaeda. Now somehow they're crawling all over the place, supposedly. Well, anyway. And of course, man, I'm sorry I don't have the footnote for this, but what was it that I read where they talked about? Well, first of all, we did talk about that Patrick Lang piece from his blog where he was saying these are the tribes. Maliki's fighting the tribes, not al-Qaeda. I think, was it him that talked about how, yeah, they put up the al-Qaeda flag until the tribal leaders told them to take it down, and they did within the hour. Sorry. Oops, yeah, they're not really the ones in charge. Man, I'm sorry, I don't think it was Patrick Lang that wrote that part. I can't remember what it was that I read about how it's the tribes. You know what, it might have been a foreign policy. I don't know, anyway. And then, so here McCain says, oh yeah, you know what, when you look at Iraq and Syria, you're seeing an al-Qaeda enclave there, he said. And that's very dangerous to American national security. Not to mention what's happening in Syria, of course, where the United States is disengaged. But he's been arguing all the time that that's the side we should be fighting on. Not against. John McCain. Remember when Joe Lieberman had to correct him live right there in front of the reporters in 2007? When he claimed that, oh yeah, you know, we might have to attack Iran because there are al-Qaeda fighters from Iraq who are going to Iran for training. Oh man, you don't even have any idea who's on whose side over there, do you? You're the one fighting on Iran's side against al-Qaeda in Iraq, stupid. If al-Qaeda guys go to Iran, they get arrested and or killed. It's the lawless Anbar province where you've given them free reign, where they run free, and they're backed by our allies, the Saudis. And anyway, and Joe Lieberman leaned in and said, no, 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 it's extremists. Just say extremists. Oh, yeah, Iran, yeah, they're training extremists. Oh, really? Now here he is saying, yeah, America ought to be backing al-Qaeda in Syria and fighting against them in Iraq. And I know the double thing, and he claims he's saying fight them in Syria. But, so what does that mean? He ought to be back, we ought to be back in the al-Nusra front, good al-Qaeda, against the ISIS, bad al-Qaeda? Really? And is it simply a matter of the war going on so long that new factions get so bad that bad factions become okay, not by getting better, but just by having other people worse than them around? Well, you know, the al-Nusra front, they like to cut people's heads off. They had to apologize when there was a guy in the hospital was wounded, and they mistakenly thought that they heard him whimper a prayer to a Shiite saint or idol or something. And they cut his head off. And then later on they had to apologize. In his hospital bed. They had to apologize that, well, actually, yeah, he was a nice Sunni boy who meant no harm. Those are the guys that we need to be backing, right? You got to pick your al-Qaeda factions carefully. And, you know, here, you know, David Enders, I didn't even realize this, man, but I went back and saw that I've been interviewing David Enders since 2005, since before anti-war radio. I was interviewing him. I don't know who he was writing for back then when he was covering the Iraq war there. And I asked David Enders on this show about how, hey, man, remember how it was always a gigantic lie, just like it is right now, that any time that America or the Shiites fight the Sunnis in Iraq, that all Sunni insurgents are all Al-Qaeda guys because they were only ever the tiniest part of the insurgency? And David Enders says, yeah. And I say, well, is that the case here in Syria, too, where you have, you know, basically a broad-based, widespread Sunni insurgency, and then the Al-Qaeda fighters are just, you know, a few Iraqis, a small percentage, who are just glommed on and trying to hog all the credit and hog all the headlines, like in Iraq? And he goes, no. They are the insurgency. Al-Nusra Front is the insurgency in Syria. And then that was before the split with ISIS, which I guess, the way they say anyway, ISIS is mostly Iraqis. And al-Nusra, even though it was begun by Iraqis, I guess it was begun by Iraqis and Syrian veterans of the Iraqi war. And anyway, so they're a little bit more nationalist. And this is the same kind of thing in both places, is the same kind of argument I've been making all along, which is that if America, I think they prove it, I've been making this case, and yeah, the things about them make what I say seem right to me, like this. If America just cuts and runs completely from the Middle East, no more torture dictators, no more occupations, no more drone strikes, no more nothing, just leave them alone, all this Al-Qaeda terrorism will dry up. Certainly, any of this terrorism directed toward the United States, it'll dry up quick. And really, I think just the movements themselves will dry up pretty quick. Of course, you know, the Saudis and the Iranians would have to make peace. That'd be a big part of that, taking the money out from behind them, the Saudi money out from behind them. But also, they are such jerks, these Al-Qaeda guys. They suicide bomb schools and marketplaces full of women and children. They go around cutting people's hands off, cutting people's heads off, conscripting people's sons, claiming that they memorized something that somebody told them was in the Quran that they can't read, that says that they get to, you know, forbid you from smoking cigarettes and whatever. I don't know a lot about Syria, but I'm under the impression that they like smoking cigarettes in Syria. It's kind of a cultural thing about Syrians. They're smokers, a lot of them. Much higher percentages than here in the United States. Well, the Al-Qaeda guys who claim they're fighting for these people are the same ones running around beating them over the head and forbidding them from smoking. Like Mayor Bloomberg, only with a suicide bomb belt on. They're the ultimate, you know, commie Nazis, totalitarians. And why would anybody put up with that crap? Why would anybody put up with that crap? The only reason the Iraqis put up with it at all for a few years was they were helping fight the American and Iranian attempt to install the Dawah and Supreme Islamic Council and Sadrists in power in Baghdad. And so, geez, I guess as long as you're helping us fight them, okay. But that only went so far. They turned on them at the drop of a hat. Like I said before in the show, they tried to turn on them over and over again before America finally gave them the chance to in 2007. So, you know, I don't know. Somebody tell the Democrats to call the Saudis and tell the Saudis to stop backing Al-Qaeda in Syria. And I know, I mean, what they say, and maybe it's true, that what the Saudis are trying to do is they're the ones propping up this Islamic front, and it's supposed to head off the Al-Qaeda types at the pass. It's supposed to, you know, become the new, bigger, broader umbrella group that ISIS and al-Nusra will have to be subordinate to. But who believes in that? Who thinks that that's really what's going to happen here? Oh, yeah, the moderates are taking over the fight from the extremists. Uh-huh, yeah. Just like the Free Syrian Army that just finished turning tail and leaving. I'm supposed to believe now that the Islamic Front is a powerhouse. Really, where'd it come from? It beamed down from space? Because this whole time, the insurgency has been dominated by al-Nusra and then by ISIS. And the Free Syrian Army, which is also made up of, you know, jihadist veterans of the Iraq War, who fought Americans in the Iraq War, they're all falling apart. They lost everything and ran and live in Turkey now, or moved back to Virginia, where the CIA bought them a giant house. You know? Amazing. You know what I think? I think John McCain ought to have to go to war in Syria and Iraq. Just leave him over there for however long. I never really came up with an exit strategy for him. I don't think I need one. I don't think he needs one. Stay for 100 years, however long it takes, right? Make those people see it our way.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our guest today is Reza Marashi from the National Iranian American Council. That's NIAcouncil.org. And you're formerly the Deputy Associate Assistant Secretary of State for making peace with Iran or something like that, was it?
I did spend a couple of years working at the State Department, and the goal was definitely to make peace, but hopefully we can still do that even when we're not in government.
Yeah, it seems like you probably got a better chance from here, Reza. Hey, listen, I saw you on CNN out of the corner of my eye when I was complaining about something unrelated earlier, but it was actually right during the commercial break and everything. I didn't get a chance to pot up the volume and hear you, but so now's my chance. We got important doings going on. First of all, the good news is that they say that, I don't know what they mean by this. They finalized the deal, the interim deal, they finalized the details of the implementation of the interim deal. Is that it? What?
Yeah. So on November 24th in Geneva, they reached an agreement, the permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany and Iran, were negotiating. Three rounds in Geneva, and many, many rounds before that, but the three rounds in Geneva were the ones that happened after the new Iranian president took office in August. Those were the important ones, where real progress was made. So when you strike a deal, and you have so many convoluted aspects, so many technical details pertaining to sanctions and the various aspects of Iran's nuclear program, the science of it and all that, then you need a couple of months to figure out, okay, now we know what each side is going to do. Now we have to figure out who does what when. What's the timetable? So, for example, what's the timetable for Iran getting the actual money that will constitute sanctions relief? That's something they figured out in these recent negotiations. And then also, what's the timetable for the actual technical rollbacks on the Iranian nuclear program that will take place? So these things take time to hammer out. They've been hammered out, and on January 20th, the deal will actually start to be implemented, and that's very positive because as most sides take a step back from escalating the conflict, we're really taking a step back from war, from the brink of war, and I think that should be everybody's goal.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, now, on that particular point, it's a bit overstated, right? Because that sort of accepts the false premise that, one, they really are trying to make nuclear bombs over there, and two, that America, Israel, or anybody else has the right or necessarily would have to start a war to prevent them, or that even starting a war would prevent them from making nuclear bombs. And none of that's right, right?
Well, I don't think it speaks to that. I don't think that a war is necessary to reach some kind of resolution to this problem, and nor do I think that Iran taking steps to roll back aspects of its program lend credence to that. Yeah, and I also don't think that just because Iran has made a decision to roll back aspects of its program means that sanctions worked, for example. What did sanctions really do? Sanctions hurt innocent people. We know that. Sanctions have, given America leverage, but at what cost? If sanctions give leverage to the United States, you could just as easily say that 19,000 centrifuges in Iran give the Iranians leverage. So what we're really doing here at the end of the day is both sides are saying, all right, you're doing something I don't like. So I'm willing to take steps to stop doing those things if you're willing to take steps to stop doing the things that I don't like. Yeah? So both sides are de-escalating the conflict simultaneously, step by step, right, irrespective of what people think that their aspirations are or what their true intentions are. Trust doesn't matter at this point because they're taking verifiable steps. So if either side cheats, the deal is over.
Right. Well, I just think that, you know, the argument, and I appreciate it when, you know, the president, for example, says that those pushing sanctions, and I'm skipping ahead, but that those people who are so against this deal, that what they really want is war, they should be honest about that. I kind of appreciate that tone, but it still sort of sets up the idea that, I mean, after all, from my point of view, Reza, it seems like if this deal fell apart, well, the status quo can hold indefinitely, because the status quo is still a safeguarded civilian nuclear program, after all, and the status quo is still just a bunch of hot air from the West this whole time. So I don't like it. I prefer a deal to the status quo, but I don't see the status quo as even necessarily the path to war, or it shouldn't have to be. You know what I mean?
I don't think it should have to be, but I think the political realities in Washington are so toxic, and the political realities in Tehran are so toxic, too, that if diplomacy doesn't succeed, if it doesn't make progress over a sustained period of time where both sides make concessions and compromise, then the process could fall apart, and that empowers hardliners who want to take things in a much more negative direction. So then you would have hardliners in the United States wanting to increase sanctions, secret assassinations of Iranian scientists, computer viruses on the Iranian program, all the things that we were doing in the past that got us to the precipice of a military conflict. And the Iranians could take steps to advance their program beyond the levels that they've ever reached at the current date that would be considered provocative in Western capitals. So there's a political aspect to this, in addition to the actual technical aspect as well. And sometimes the political, as you know very well, can overshadow the reality. And, you know, whether or not we like it, we got to take it into consideration.
Right. And by the way, how precarious is President Rouhani's political position in Iran right now compared to his McCain's over there?
Well, I think what we have right now is an Iranian president who's created one of the most diverse and well-rounded political coalitions in Iranian political history. But, you know, alliances and enmities can shift. So the further we get away from his actual election date in June and him taking office in August, the more likely it becomes that if he doesn't make progress on delivering the promises not only that he made to the Iranian people, but to his political allies as well, his coalition could fracture. So far, though, because he's made progress on the foreign policy front and to a lesser extent, but still to a certain extent on the domestic policy front, his coalition has stayed together. He also has the support of the supreme leader in Iran, which is very helpful. But the supreme leader is not the end-all, be-all. He's just one of the most important guys. So he's doing well so far. There's always a risk, whether you're talking about Iran or the United States, that political coalitions that you build up could fracture, could dissipate. Obama has the same problem, as you see now, with people in Congress trying to shove more sanctions down his throat. But at the end of the day, the political aspect is always going to be there. So if you're going to let that be an obstacle, then you're never going to get anything done.
Right. Well, you know, there's some very pro-Israel type politicians in the Democratic Party in Washington, D.C., who have sided with the president on this. I'm thinking specifically of Dianne Feinstein and a few others in the Senate. And I wonder, what I haven't heard from them, although, you know, you're there in D.C., so you may know better than me. I'm curious whether anybody like Dianne Feinstein, who's, you know, supporting the president on this, but we know also really puts Israeli security high on their list of priorities as well. Do they seem surprised at all at the vociferous opposition? I can't even talk today. It's the Benadryl is my excuse. The opposition and the strength behind the opposition to this deal and the support for new sanctions, which are obviously meant to sabotage the deal?
I don't think anybody in Congress or the Obama administration that are supporting this deal are surprised, because really since President Obama came into office, the relationship that he's had with Congress hasn't been a very good one. Congress has not been very helpful to the president in achieving any of very many of his foreign policy or domestic policy objectives. When he came into office, you had people like Mitch McConnell saying our goal is to make him a one-term president. Not to repair the economy, not to, you know, do things that are at service for the American people, is to make him a one-term president. And so the dysfunction that we see as a result I think, has left everybody really clear-eyed about what the obstacles are. So I don't think it's taken them by surprise. I think it just has added to a level of frustration that already existed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess, yeah, I didn't phrase my question very well, but I'm sort of thinking that, you know, for Dianne Feinstein to side with the president on this, it's not just politics. She buys it, that she trusts him, that this is a deal that is really going to roll back their program enough that it's going to make her feel better about it, and she believes that Israel's security will be will benefit from this. This is not just some DC game or something like that. This is something that's very important, and it seems like everyone who's supporting the sanctions and trying to undermine the deal claims that what they're trying to do is protect Israel from this nuclear program and what could become of it, but they're the ones who really are creating a situation where that nuclear program is much more likely to ever become a weapons program and become an actual security risk instead of just a rhetorical one.
Yeah, no, I think you nailed it. You know, it's not just Senator Feinstein who's buying what the president is selling on Iran right now about why this is a good deal. The intelligence community, not just of the United States, but also the European Union and Israel, have come out and said that this is a good deal, meaning that if new sanctions were to be introduced, it would ruin the diplomatic process and it would increase the likelihood that Iran might pursue a nuclear weapon sometime in the future, because thankfully they're not doing that right now, according to the various intelligence agencies. So I think Senator Feinstein and those who are thinking like her are on the right side of this. The right side of this issue. And, the president is going to hold a meeting with the Senate Democratic Caucus this week on Wednesday, if I'm not mistaken, try and give them some more information that can empower them and, for lack of a better term, convince them that supporting this process, the diplomatic process, and giving peace a chance, as opposed to supporting new sanctions in Congress that could very much destroy the process and ruin one of the best opportunities we've had to solve this conflict peacefully in 3 decades. Is not worth doing. And hopefully he will be able to, the facts speak for themselves. So hopefully they can come up with a way to empower these individuals politically, because if you're in Congress, whether you're in the House or the Senate, that's what it is about the end of the day. What's good for you politically? What's going to help you get reelected? Things like that. And I think that the president and his team are trying to come up with a good way to empower these folks in that way as well, besides the obvious facts that anybody who's being intellectually honest will admit to.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hate to be the one siding with presidential supremacy on pretty much any issue, but they're trying to create a veto-proof majority in the Senate for these new sanctions. And it's just incredible. And even the CIA, as you mentioned, has officially said, it's the official intelligence professional position of the American government, that these sanctions will sabotage the deal.
Yeah. And, here's the funny thing. If the intelligence community came out and said tomorrow that in 24 hours, Iran will make a decision to construct a nuclear weapon, Congress would be all over that. And they would use that as justification for their new sanctions and whatever other crazy measures they might want to take up.
And never mind, they're the ones who made it that way.
Yeah, so it's ridiculous at the end of the day. They're playing political football on issues that are quite literally could be war and peace. And it's irresponsible. There's a reason why Congress's approval rating is so low. It's because they are consistently going against what the American people are not only voting for them to do when they vote them into office, but also they're also going against the president himself when the president has a very clear and convincing case to make.
Yep. All right, now hold it right there. When we get back from this very short break, we're going to talk with Reza Marashi a little bit about that public opinion and more on America's relationship with Iran and the new nuclear deal. We'll be right back after this.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire, the permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And we're talking with Reza Marashi from the National Iranian American Council. That's NIAcouncil.org. He's formerly with the State Department and a great analyst of American-Iran policy. And you talked about the president has a great case to make, which, you know, just happens to in this case. He's on the right side of this, and Congress on the wrong side of it. And then also, you made reference there, Reza, to the American people's support for this. Now, when the lobby and, I guess, Raytheon, I don't know if anybody else was for it, but when the lobby was trying to push us into war with Syria last summer, end of last summer, the American people unanimously, basically, said absolutely not. And just the whole thing ground to a complete halt. The problem is, it's hard to get them as animated in their support for steps toward peace as it is to get them to, you know, really rear up on their hind legs about an impending war, which, you know, as grateful as we are for that. And I noticed that there was a real discrepancy in the polls. At first, they said, aha, the American people are against this fool's deal. Said all the right-wing media. But then when I go Googling it, I don't know what they're talking about, because all the polls I find say that the American people support these negotiations and the interim deal and the steps toward a final deal, etc., by 2/3 to 1/3. So I was wondering if you could help explain the discrepancy in that to me. Do you know?
Yeah, sure. I mean, long story short, there are numerous polls that have been put out that more or less test this premise about whether or not the American people support the deal. More specifically, and diplomacy with Iran more generally. All of them, with the exception of one that I've seen, have overwhelmingly supported not only the deal, but diplomacy with Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that a poll is conducted, the methodology behind a poll, will oftentimes play a factor in what kind of results you get. So how you ask the question and what question you ask goes a long way in determining what kind of response you get. And I think that speaks volumes. So if you have one poll that's giving you a different outcome than all the rest of them, you know, then I think it kind of goes to show that they probably didn't do a very good job with the methodology in terms of the questions they were asking, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, beyond a shadow of a doubt, vast majority of American people deeply support the diplomatic process. They do not want another war. And I think President Obama actually deserves some credit on this one for doing what's necessary to try to take some risks for peace.
Yeah. And now, so what's it like in D.C. as far as you know, the atmosphere? Obviously, there, you know, we talked about this near veto-proof majority of senators who have co-signed onto this bill, or at least promised to co-sign onto it. But is there much pressure at all from the peace movement or activists of any kind, you know, on Capitol Hill? Are people going around teaching true facts about what's going on here, as opposed to just the Winnep spin? Or is the lobby just has the whole argument in the bag inside the Beltway there, or what?
They certainly don't have the whole argument in the bag. I think that their presence on Capitol Hill is more organized, and so far it's been more effective than the anti-war movement on this particular issue. But, you know, we're not anywhere close to the ninth inning on this. You know, yeah. We still have a ways to go.
And there are big parts of the establishment who really want this deal too, right?
Exactly. So the stars kind of align in favor of those who are pushing back against the line of, you know, this is a bad deal, or, you know, we need more sanctions now, or this hurts Israel. You know, all of these things that are, you know, great talking points, but not factually accurate. So I think as time goes on, momentum will build, and you're going to see some pretty significant pushback. And this is, again, where I give Obama credit, because Obama was more forward-leaning in comments that he made on December 7th at the Brookings Institution, which is the first time where he framed this as a choice between war and peace, yeah? And that was far more forward-leaning than the vast majority of folks flanking him to the left that were supporting his positions. And so when a president does that, it creates space for people on the left to be even more forward-leaning, and people in the center, too, quite frankly. Because when you only have hardliners on the right, the far right, opposing what you're doing, but they happen to have, you know, a good amount of influence in Congress, the president taking steps like that is a very powerful thing.
Mm. And now, can you tell me about what happened with the Israeli intelligence officers coming and briefing Congress? Because I think that's pretty much unprecedented. I don't know, maybe the Brits came and briefed them during World War II or something, but that is kind of surprising to me. And then especially hearing all the warmongering spin coming out of those meetings, because I had read in Haaretz where Mossad used the exact language as the CIA in saying, we judge with high confidence that they have not made the political decision to begin to make nuclear weapons. I mean, they're straight plagiarizing the American intelligence agency's assessment there and adopting it as their own, according to the Tel Aviv dailies. So what's going on with that?
Well, I think when you send up political officials or intelligence officials from Israel to Capitol Hill to make an argument, you choose your words very carefully. And the argument they were making when they were up there, at least one of the more recent times that they were up there, which I think is what made the headlines, is, you know, they tried to say this is a bad deal because it'll give more Iran more money than what the Obama administration is saying it will give in terms of sanctions relief. They tried to make the case that there would be a ripple effect so that beyond the $7 billion that Iran is estimated to receive over the course of this six-month interim deal, it will be somewhat closer to $20 billion. And nobody else had those numbers. Nobody else made that case. It was something that was fed directly to the Congress and then spun out into the media. And, you know, that's politics. And that's all it is at the end of the day, because it's certainly not factually accurate. And nobody has those numbers except for you, I think that speaks volumes.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I knew that that story was going around right-wing circles, but I didn't realize that that was where it had originated. That was the best that they could do, huh, was the money angle. Interesting.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to go against an agreement. It's hard to make a case against the technical aspects of this agreement, because it verifiably rolls back aspects of Iran's nuclear program that Israel has for years been saying that they found troubling. So now they're getting some of what they want, and they're going to complain about it? No, of course they can't do that. I mean, maybe they will in the future, I don't know, but they can't do that now. They have to make an argument about why, oh, we should have asked for more, or, you know, this is why it's a bad deal, because if you come across as looking disingenuous too many times, then it turns into a boy who cried wolf type scenario, and I don't think the Israelis want that.
Yeah. All right, now, so pretend that my entire audience just tuned in from listening to the Rush Limbaugh show and sell them this deal, why this is a good thing.
Well, we need to put America's national security interests first. And the people who are selling you this line, this argument, that the deal that Obama has crafted with Iran is a bad one, are the same people that were selling you the Iraq War. And we know how that turned out. So if you know something doesn't work, do you keep doing it, or do you try something different? No, you try something different, knowing full well that this option, more sanctions, potentially war, is certainly in the back pocket. Nobody's ruling that out, not even the president. So why have a Ministry of Foreign Affairs, why have a Department of State, if you're not going to utilize the skills of those diplomats to try and give peace a chance, to try and give diplomacy a chance? If the intelligence community, the military, the State Department, the White House, the Pentagon, if everybody in the United States except a handful of hawkish senators and members of Congress, House of Representatives, if they're the only ones saying that this isn't a good idea, then we need to ask ourselves, who do we listen to? All these people on one side, or this very small group of extremists on the other?
Yeah, but Rez, I told you, pretend they all just got here from the Rush Limbaugh show. And of course, the entire government is riddled with the Muslim Brotherhood or who knows what kind of Kenyan-born traitors. And furthermore, those Iranians, man, they are sneaky. And guess what else? They hate us. And guess what else? They call us Satan and they burn our flag. And I know for a fact they got nuclear material in that country. They're trying to make bombs out of it. And they're willing to die if they can just kill some Jews. So why in the world should we trust the Democrats of all people to negotiate with some madmen like that on our behalf? Come on.
Yeah, you don't have to trust Democrats or Republicans. That's the beauty of this deal. Everything that we've signed on to in this deal is 100% verifiable by the United States intelligence community and by the International Atomic Energy Agency. So if Iran cheats on its side of the deal falls apart, and then all of the kinds of punishment that Rush Limbaugh's listeners want to inflict upon Iran is very likely going to happen. So if you want that kind of punishment, then, you know, sit tight. But if you don't want that kind of punishment, or if you think that potentially we could get what we want, which is a peaceful outcome that stops Iran from doing things that we don't want them to do, then there's another way, and we can give that way a shot, because it's the same thing that a lot of former Bush administration officials, believe it or not, are coming out and saying that we need to do now, too. So there's a growing chorus of voices that are saying that we don't lose a whole heck of a lot by giving this a shot. And I think that's a very powerful message that even Rush Limbaugh's listeners would maybe pause and consider for a minute.
Yeah. You know, I got to admit, though, you're kind of frightening me out of it, where it's just like Scott Ritter wrote this thing for Al Jazeera back in 2005. Instead of Plan A, Plan B, and Plan C, well, we'll try to negotiate with them through the Europeans. Well, we'll try a little of this, we'll try a little of that, and then if we have to, then we'll have to go to war. He said you should look at it like steps 1, 2, and 3. And I guess his step three is we tried every kind of way to negotiate with these people, and now there's no option left than war. And I think if that's the case, and I would have preferred where we were last October with no real progress in the negotiations and just the endless status quo of empty threats. Because if this thing falls apart, and there's a lot pushing against it, if it does fall apart, and like you say, that leads us that much closer to war, I think we might have done better without any negotiations at all. You know, that's a lot of reason to really see this thing through if possible, man.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, if the White House is coming out and saying very publicly, you know, with the backing of the intelligence community, the military, the State Department, et cetera, coming out and saying exactly that, we need to see this through because the alternative is a very grim one. I think that goes to show that they're putting forth some effort that we really haven't seen. We're in uncharted waters now. And the Iranians understand the same thing. They're in uncharted waters, too. You know, John Kerry said in passing the other day, Secretary of State John Kerry said the other day in passing when he was at the podium giving a press conference that he had picked up the phone and called the Iranian foreign minister. 6 months ago, that was an impossible thing to consider,
right?
But it never would have happened, and now it's something so standard that it's mentioned in passing by.
Right.
So we're making progress.
Good deal. All right, thanks very much, Reza. I sure appreciate your time on the show as always.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right, everybody. That is Reza Marashi from NIAcouncil.org, the National Iranian American Council. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.